At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, joined by Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow for the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. This document from SCOTUS blog dated June 28th of this year. In a major ruling, the Supreme Court cut back sharply on the power of federal agencies to interpret the laws they administer and ruled that courts should rely on their own interpretation of ambiguous laws. This is the Chevron deference. It dates from 1984, the Chevron versus Natural Resources, which gave rise to the doctrine known as the Chevron Doctrine. Under that doctrine, if Congress has not directly addressed the question at the center of a dispute, a court was required to uphold the agency's interpretation of the statute as long as it was reasonable. In a 35-page ruling by Chief Justice Roberts, the justices rejected that doctrine, calling it, quote, fundamentally misguided. Professor, a very good evening to you. Your most recent article with your colleague, Mr. Loyola, is advancing the opinion that Justice Roberts did right, did amazingly right. And we need to celebrate Justice Roberts for reversing what you'd have to say is FDR's worst idea as president, which was packing the court. Can I connect those two events, 1937 and the court packing, with the Chevron deference and how the courts have permitted the executive branch to get more and more powerful until this moment? Good evening to you.
Well, I mean, there are certain parallels, but there are fundamental differences as well. The 1937 fight was about a court that was obdurate and refused to go along with the New Deal, and Roosevelt decided to threaten them. And in the end, the threat half worked, in the sense he didn't get the packing, but led by Chief Justice Hughes, they reversed all the classical liberal small government decisions that had been made previously and essentially did create a very large space for a very powerful administrative state. Chevron, of course, did the same thing, but they did it by a very different technique. There was no question here about trying to upset the balance within the court. And the ideas that here were generated not so much in the White House or even in the Congress. They were generated by the court itself. The issue in Chevron was a classic kind of question, is what counts as a facility when you're trying to regulate? Is a facility a factory which has lots of smokestacks in a given location, very close to one another? Or is a facility or a source, as they call it, simply one of the smokestacks? And it turns out there was a big political rivalry with respect to that. The American left wanted every smokestack to be its own entity, so that if you wanted to switch output from one smokestack to another smokestack, you would have to get a permit of some kind from the EPA to do so. What the Republicans said is, if you have a very narrow compass and you could figure out a better way to run the plant, you can improve output without increasing pollution, and you should encourage that, which means you don't want to have these judicial vetoes. So what was going on, in a sense, was a part of the American left being very suspicious about American business, and the more conservative Reagan forces deciding that it was much better to have that kind of an arrangement. But what Justice Stevens did was a very odd amalgam. He said that on the particular case, I'm going to cede to the Reagan administration, which had overturned the Carter administration, but it was only because they had deference. It wasn't because they were right. And as Mario Lowell and I wrote when we did our particular piece, it was pretty clear that the correct answer to a case like this is that if you have these things that don't increase pollution and do increase efficiency, then getting the government out of the way is a very fine thing to do so. This was not a case where you're trying to increase pollution in Colorado by reducing it in Indiana, where the trade-offs would be much more complex. And the second point, of course, is where was the expertise that was involved in making these judgments? There was no expertise that was involved in making this particular kind of judgment. Most of the technical judgments that were made by the Democrats were just plain wrong. The question there was, governed by Section 306 of the Administrative Procedure Act, which had been passed in 1946 as an effort to curb the power of agencies to do all sorts of things. And they said the question of what do you mean by some kind of a facility or a smokestack or a source is a question of law, and questions of law are normally interpreted by courts. They're not interpreted by agency. Agencies have a degree of expertise on technical matters, but the problem that the agencies often have is a huge degree of bias in favor of one side or another. And so what the Chevron deference did was it made it impossible for people to have long-term plans about developing facility, because if the Democrats come in, you're going to get a very rough time. The moment they leave, the Republicans are going to relax the rules. Democrats come again, and you can't build a plant that takes you 10 years to complete when you have three changes in the legal rules by different administrations with different points of view. And if you actually look at some of the decisions that were made under the Chevron doctrine, what is a reasonable interpretation by an administrator is a highly ambiguous term. And the term ambiguity in the statute is itself highly ambiguous. So that you've got two lines of authorities under the cases. One line, a case called Baltimore Gas, was, hey, they got a bunch of professional guys. We looked at what they did. They actually know how to run a nuclear power program. God bless them. And then it turns out you get the Chevron case coming down the next year where it's just completely muddled because they didn't understand what the technology was and they didn't understand how the thing started to work. And so it's a very difficult question to figure out where you put the power in these particular cases. But generally speaking, it sounds very naive. But if you understand the plain meaning of a text against its standard normative background, you're going to do better than coming up with ad hoc justification for this or that kind of restriction. To give you but one example, there was a famous case that came to the Supreme Court 10 years apart called Sackett. And in this particular case, Mr. and Mrs. Sackett owned a small plot of land about 600 feet from Priest Lake. Along the lake, there were a bunch of piers and jetties and houses, and they wanted to build a house. And the government said, you can't build that house because you're going to destroy a wetland. And you can see the picture of this house stopped in the middle of everything, just dirt strewn around all the place. And the government said, this is what we have to do. And we have the power under Chevron, because if we have the power to regulate navigable waters of the United States, we have the power to regulate uplands within 600 feet of the United States of that water, and indeed sometimes many miles. That's what you call Chevron deference. And it was just crazy. There was not the slightest chance of anything going wrong at that time. And if something happened later on, the government had ample authority to stop pollution when it turned out to start. That case became a poster child of everything that's wrong with administrative discretion. And it turned out the problem with Justice Kagan in dissent and so forth is she never addressed the abuses. What she did is she said, well, I've got these wonderful programs and I want to see that they go. And therein lies the rub. The Democrats generally want to expand regulatory power, so they love Chevron. The Republicans are much less inclined to do so, and so they're much more suspicious of it. I don't think there was anything whatsoever wrong with the Roberts opinion, even though I do disagree with him on many other issues.
The Roberts opinion is Loper Bright versus Raimondo, the earlier case. And this was, to encapsulate it, the regulatory agency insisted upon having one of its inspectors on the fishing boat. And therefore, there was an imposition of costs on the fishermen. And there was no due process available because...
That wasn't quite right. The exact fact is they were required already by statute to keep somebody on the boat, but their budgets ran short. And so what the agency decided independently is these small shipping boats would have to pay for the agent whom the government put on those boats, eating very substantially into profits. And the simple explanation is they're trying to use an agency to make an appropriation. And that's a function which is generally starts in the House and then has to be approved by the Senate and signed by the president. And so it was the financing side that was wrong. And what happened in that particular case is the agency said, we're going to allow a massive transfer of powers away from Congress to these guys because the statute itself was ambiguous about what it meant to provide for a boat. And to give you an idea of how crazy the doctrine went, there were three different opinions. There was one set of guys who said it's perfectly clear you can't have them on the boat at their own expense. You have to pay for them. The other side said it was perfectly clear the other way. And then there were people in the middle. So one of the tragedies of Chevron is it leads to a massive abuse in the way in which we start to think about what a statute actually means. Ambiguity is an ambiguous term. And a lot of things that what these guys are trying to do is to manufacture ambiguity in order to allow them to do whatever they want. And so ask yourself the question, is a territorial sea an upland? And if you sort of say, you know the difference between land and water, you know what the answer has to be. But by the time you got through the Chevron deference technique, it turned out land and water were more or less the same thing, a great achievement, owing itself entirely to administrative expertise.
Is it true, Professor, that there's no due process in this logic, that you don't have a court you can go to and say that they're wrong?
Well, they would say no. They would say you could go to court and challenge this. That's due process, but you have to give deference to the agency. But the agency deference in some cases becomes absolute, so it looks as though it's just a straight expropriation of wealth. But one of the problems that you have in dealing with this doctrine is this current Supreme Court is very interested in the separation of powers. It is utterly uninterested in the protection of property rights as an independent element. The most important case in trying to deal with that was the situation that happened in the rent control case, 74 Pinehurst, in which New York landlords said, we're going to be bankrupt by what's going on in this case. And the Supreme Court refused to take a really oppressive rent control scheme and subject to any kind of difficulty. And Justice Thomas, the so-called champion of privacy rights, wrote a milk toast opinion saying, we know there are 900,000 opinion apartments or more under rent control. Anybody who wants to bring an individual case, let them do so. And it's going to be so costly and so utterly unproductive, nothing will happen. But nobody's going to go and simply say the problem about rent control is you have a reversion in your property, that is after the term of the lease, and it's worth $1 million. And by the time the rent control system is done, you get $200,000 for it, and the rest of it is pure expropriation. So they're not interested in due process when it comes to property. It's the great weakness of this Supreme Court. This is rather different from what it was in the 1980s, where there was some real consideration of how the property issues ought to be done. But I give this court very low marks as a collective institution.
I want to praise Justice Roberts.
You can do that on this. Don't praise him on property rights questions.
So what we have here is the Chevron deference is gone, but the court still has a weakness in property. Is that how you're explaining
it? Yeah, because what happens is they do very little to control taxation and very little to control regulation with respect to real estate and so forth. So that what happens is they make sure that the administrative agencies follows the law, but if the laws are totally corrupt on the way in which they deal with these issues, there's no independent backup. But to have an effective constitutional limitation, you have to have both the structural piece on the one hand and the property rights piece on the other hand, and that last piece is one that is sorely missing today. And the Supreme Court actually made things a little worse in that direction this term, when in all the cases having to do with net choice and the question of what the government can do to suppress media of one kind or another, they said, oh, there's no standing to challenge the abuses of the Biden administration. And they got away with holy murder in the way in which they started to regulate some of these companies. Really pretty blatant threats of we're going to take you down, and pretty blatant promises we'll give you a lot if you go along with us. So you have a very inconsistent court, and you need to do the whole thing. The Constitution added a Bill of Rights because they realized structural protections were not enough. And this Supreme Court seems, except perhaps in some speech or religion cases, perfectly willing to let those property rights go by the wayside. And the price in a place like New York is very, very expensive. The entire real estate market is in turmoil because of the extreme regulation that were put into place in 2019 and tightened since that date.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Nash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.